This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The opioid epidemic in this country is taking its toll in the Chattanooga area during the global COVID-19 pandemic. Last year, according to the Hamilton County Medical Examiner's Office, 270 residents in this county died due to COVID-19, while 160 died from overdoses and drug-related deaths. Knox Farmer is marketing director at CADIS, the Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Services here in Chattanooga. Calandra Smith is agency coordinator at the Hamilton County Coalition, a nonprofit that also fights drug abuse. Knox, Calandra, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Give us the big picture about overdoses in East Tennessee in the past year, given the pandemic.
Yeah, I think everybody has seen the headlines in Chattanooga, and I think some of those where there was, a 22% increase in overdoses in the state of Tennessee. More importantly, Hamilton County or Chattanooga actually also saw a 50% increase in drug-related deaths. And so we definitely see that the pandemic has definitely been the facilitator of those increases, both in substance abuse and mental health. Nationally, we've seen actually synthetic opioid deaths rise by as much as 55%. We've also seen deaths by methamphetamine and other stimulants that have risen by 46%. So we are seeing a pandemic inside of a pandemic. CADIS has met that kind of head on, and we've remained open. We've had to do some things internally through this past year to kind of keep all of our programs open. It has not been without its challenges or its struggles. One of the biggest heartfelt facts is that those that are in early recovery when this pandemic started, it's such a challenge because somebody that's in recovery or needing help or assistance with substance abuse needs that support. We have had to get creative in a lot of areas to provide that.
And there's the economic piece of all this.
Absolutely. People are dealing with isolation is probably the biggest factor that has hit the hardest. Grief, the loss of loved ones, financial stress, normal stress. And really what we found is that people's coping skills have just been shattered. And for those that were dealing with substance abuse pre-COVID, that has been a struggle. We've also seen folks that were social drinkers that before have gone home and haven't been able to be at work. And so you have seen an increase in their drinking as much as 25 to 30% intake. And so now here they are ready to go back to work. And they now have tapped into a disease that has taken hold of them. They may not be able to function when they go back to work.
We have read a lot about fentanyl in all this. Tell us how severe the problem is.
Fentanyl is the leading cause that we're seeing in the opioid overdoses. It is a synthetic opioid, and that is actually what is driving a majority of the overdoses that we are seeing. One of the things that we're seeing is the prescriptions that are written for opioids has actually gone down, but we are seeing the fentanyl increase and the overdoses in fentanyl increase through the roof exponentially, and it is an epidemic.
Calandra, tell us more about what the coalition is seeing.
So from a coalition aspect, because we work extremely closely with our law enforcement, we work along with our community agencies, community treatment centers, we have definitely been seeing an increase in the overdoses and have been seeing an increase in how many clients we have been able to refer to treatment.
And then how have solutions such as Narcan made a difference, and where are the gaps out there?
Narcan has truly made a difference. One, as a coalition that works in 10 different counties, we have been able to provide information to our Region 3 South counties and making them more aware about Narcan, that it do exist, because believe it or not, we can go to some of these counties and they don't even realize that they have access to this particular treatment that can help save a life. And so one of the goals is to make people more aware. Even if you're just getting pain medication, if you're going to your pharmacist and you're picking up any type of pain medication, any type of opioid, we're making people aware that it's important that you have Narcan, because Narcan can help save a life. And so we provide this information and this training throughout all 10 of our Region 3 South counties. And we have seen an increase in people wanting to know more about Narcan and how it works, and also know more about the stigma, the addiction stigma. So this training provides all of that.
How much are each of you seeing a difference between rural versus suburban versus urban when it comes to this problem and deploying possible solutions?
What Calandra said is right on. I think what's happening there is in the rural counties, there is a learning curve for them to be educated on the help that's there. I think in Chattanooga and some of the more urban areas, we're seeing a huge influx of folks that, like you said, through whatever stressors in life have caused them to come in and seek help. There is not one segment age population out there or county population that has not been affected.
From our experience, I do feel the numbers are underreported, especially more so in the rural areas. I think it's just, again, a lack of understanding what the problems and the issues really are and how to address those issues. And I think sometimes it comes with, we don't have that problem here. And so a lot of times we tend to have to, when we're going in and we're providing trainings and educations and providing resources, we have to remind people that it is okay. It's okay that this is happening here. This happens to anyone, no matter your race, your income. This is an across the board problem that we're seeing. And to acknowledge it and to learn more about it is going to help us start to decrease some of these overdoses.
As people are vaccinated, as mask mandates and other restrictions are lifted or rolled back in some way, what problems do you see over the horizon when it comes to these overdoses?
I think as illegal substance use and alcoholism, I think we're going to see a tsunami and a ripple effect of this that we're not really prepared for. I think there's a wave of people that latched on to the drinking aspect of this prior to deal and to cope with the stressors that are going to be a lag effect behind those that are using illicit drugs and stuff. And so I call it a tsunami. I hate to say that. I think it is another national epidemic that is going to follow a national epidemic. There's a huge concern for that. I think all treatment centers I know in Chattanooga and around the area are seeing an influx of capacity and folks needing help as the mask mandates are lifted. CADIS has done some things internally with clients being admitted and how we move clients around and allow people to congregate with other clients once they've had their rapid testing and such. I think that that's only going to grow.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And Knox, I'm glad that you mentioned alcoholism because I feel like right now, because you hear so much about overdoses, fatal overdoses, that is kind of overtaken some of the other addictions that are going on. And I agree. I think more people have turned to drinking more. We have seen that even with our client referrals. It is certainly something that I think is just going to hit us all at one time. And the treatment centers, I just hope that they're prepared and ready because it's definitely going to come. I know we're going to have some changes that are going to be made in July with the funding that's going out for unemployment. So we still have a lot of people who are unemployed that are receiving that. But once that gets cut, that's more stress. That's more things to worry about. That's more having to go back to a minimum wage job and how do I continue to pay for this and this? And that causes people to cope in different ways. And a lot of times that results in drinking and illicit drug use. It can.
I would also add kind of a population group that nobody really talks about is the adolescent group. There's a lot of adolescents out there that are an indirect dealing with stress from their parents, and their brain development is such that they can't deal with stress. And so sometimes what they do is they will turn to marijuana or illicit drugs or drinking or what have you to deal with that. And they think, oh, in a primitive state, most adolescents will go, wow, if I take this, this feels good. So now I feel better. I'm just going to keep doing it. And they're still developmental. But we have a population and age group that we need to be very mindful of that is growing up. And as they move through that age demographics, we have a real problem there. So there are some adolescents that are definitely being affected. Either it's learned behavior or they are just in a bad situation themselves, and that's how they're coping with it.
And that age group has also been disrupted by the pandemic through their education.
Yeah, absolutely. As the agency coordinator, I'm also the coordinator for our Drug-Free Communities grant. And that grant focuses on the ages from 12 to 17 for prevention. And so throughout this whole time, we have worked with a group of youth to talk about drug prevention. How are they handling being in the house all the time? How are they handling virtual school? How are you coping? What are some things that you're doing to release the stress, the anxiety, you know, and the feelings that you have? I mean, as adults, we don't even know how to handle it sometimes. So I can't even imagine as a teenager not being able to participate in your sports, not being able to, you know,
graduate,
hang out with your friends, you know, simple things that they would normally do to cope or that would help them relieve stress that they were at one point unable to do. And so speaking with them and just doing different focus groups, as he said, we learned that they turn to marijuana, they turn to vaping, also on the rise, you know, they turn to drinking. And so that's a group that we really have to be looking out for and that we really have to be having these conversations with as agencies and as treatment centers. We really have to keep them at the forefront because they are our future, and we want to make sure that they're getting through this in a healthy way.
And where can people go online for more information if they want to get help, if they want to give help in some volunteer capacity? Where can they call?
For CADIS, it would be CADIS.org. They can visit our website there. If they want to call CADIS, it's 423-756-7644. We serve everything from mental detox to adolescence to transitional housing to sober living apartments to halfway housing to residential. And I would encourage anybody that's listening to this, if you need help or you have a loved one that needs help, give CADIS a call. It is such an important, we are seeing people die. And I know there's just a huge pendulum of folks that are struggling out there. Give us a call. Let us help you. Let us get you in touch with a professional and let's get your life back on track.
You can reach out to Hamilton County Coalition. You can call the 423-305-1449. You can visit our website at hccoalition.org to sign up for trainings. If you have someone that lives here in Hamilton County that is seeking recovery and treatment, whether they have insurance or not, they can give us a call. Our New Start program will be happy to assist them to getting into what is best for them. So they can reach out to us again via our website, which is hccoalition.org, or they can dial us at 305-1449 for trainings or help with recovery.
All right. Knox, Calandra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For another perspective on the rise in overdoses and drug-related deaths during the pandemic, we turn to Dr. Rick Derenfeldt. He spent more than 10 years as a police officer and a criminal investigator before turning to academia, and he is now an assistant professor of criminal justice here on this campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Rick and his colleagues at UTC have studied the impacts of drug use, addiction, incarceration, and more in rural Tennessee. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Ray.
Last time we spoke, it was before the pandemic, and we were talking about the opioid crisis. With everything that has happened since, that crisis has not disappeared at all.
No, you're absolutely right, Ray. Unfortunately, the circumstances of the pandemic have only seemed to exacerbate the issue. We still have the raw data coming in from 2020. Preliminary analysis, though, do tell us we are continuing to see double-digit increases, not just in terms of substance misuse disorders, but also overdose deaths. Many of those are directly related to fentanyl, heroin, and then polydrug use, where they mix those with stimulants like methamphetamine. We are seeing some interesting changes in demographics. Rural areas are still suffering the brunt of it, but we are seeing some of a transition into urban markets and to city centers. Age-adjusted rates have increased around 41% since 2018. And even though the deaths from prescription opioids themselves tend to be going down, again, fentanyl is making up for that. There's still an increase among white rural Tennesseans, but we've seen a much sharper increase among black Tennesseans since 2018. In fact, their age-adjusted overdose death rate has gone from 11.4 per 100,000 to 19.1. And that's just in the span of 18 months. Much of this is being exacerbated by the circumstances of the pandemic, those things like social isolation, the economic fallout that's come from it. We were already in pretty rough shape, and the pandemic hasn't done anything to help us.
And how has the pandemic inhibited being able to reach people and help them?
For rural areas, again, it's really kind of exacerbated the issue. For many rural Tennesseans, right now we've got between 400,000 and 500,000 Tennesseans who suffer from a substance use disorder. That's obviously no small number. With stigma and the things that are attached to that, the typical response has still centered around incarceration. Right now, the fiscal budget for Tennessee prison stands at around $1.1, $1.2 billion. That's a number that's gone up like clockwork, around 6% every year, along with the prison population. So really, the most effective way to deal with this in terms of dollars and cents, and even in terms of addressing these issues head on, is to invest in evidence-based practices. And to kind of put that in context, too, for every dollar that we invest in treatment, you get a $7 savings in crime-related costs, and then another $5 in healthcare-related costs. With rural areas, we've seen this over and over in research. Having access to things like healthcare is a big thing, because you can get with a physician who can diagnose the issue and then effectively treat it once it's been diagnosed. Unfortunately, right now, these rural areas are devoid of those services. One of the most effective ways we've seen to deal with that has been the implementation of telehealth. And that really kind of came to the forefront before the pandemic, but we really started to realize its value once these areas other than rural counties or rural municipalities were being affected by the shutdowns. So in terms of care right now, only 1 in 10 Tennesseans who need treatment for a substance use disorder can actually obtain it. That is a depressing number, especially when you consider that the rate of opioid overdose has more than quadrupled since 1999. Last year, we had well over 2,000. And about a third of Tennessee counties have zero providers who prescribe the drugs that are used to treat these opioid use disorders. And again, most of those are going to be rural areas. So in terms of things like lost workplace productivity, healthcare costs, we're losing in Tennessee between $180 and $200 million a year. That's a lot of money that can be invested somewhere else. And with these barriers, 1 in 4 patients in Tennessee is traveling at least 15 miles to the nearest clinic. 10% are traveling an average 50 miles to another state. That's the best they can do. So having access to things like telehealth enables them to start networking with health providers to start addressing the problem head on when they're ready to actually receive treatment. Hand in hand in that, we really have to start thinking outside the box and innovate a little bit. Broadband has actually been crucial to addressing substance use disorders. So right now, approximately 500,000 Tennesseans, again, mostly in rural areas, they lack access to broadband. So this has actually been a focal point of some of the legislation that Governor Lee has been asking to be brought up in the State House and Senate. He's asked for a state broadband development budget from $15 million to $200 million, somewhere in that range. And that does allow for the expansion of things like telehealth to improve substance use disorders. And it's also, again, a major money saver with what we invest in that versus what we pay out in criminal justice and healthcare costs. There's also a lot of other net benefits that come with investing in broadband. That kind of infrastructure brings with it a lot of businesses, more employment opportunities, greater expenditures on luxuries, more taxes that can be used to fund public projects. And we don't have to look far for success stories. Hamilton County is actually a big one. Chattanooga became the first city in the U.S. to provide public broadband internet to all of its residents, and that was in 2010. To do that, we received a loan of $169 million and then a $111 million grant from the federal government. They anticipated at that time we would need 42,000 internet subscribers to break even. Right. By 2016, they had 83,000. That investment has been associated directly with $1 billion in economic growth, including the creation of around 5,200 new jobs, and that's just in Hamilton County. So you imagine what can be done if we make those same investments in rural Tennessee, these communities that have been left behind and are disproportionately suffering from the opioid epidemic and other substance misuse disorders. The writing's kind of on the wall.
Beyond the data and the potential solutions, what are you hearing from people that you talk to in these areas on a regular basis?
More sad stories than happy ones. I think people are desperate for a solution for themselves, for their loved ones, for their communities. They're looking for answers, actively seeking them out. Unfortunately, just they're in short supply because they live in rural areas. We've watched consistently over the last couple of decades, these rural communities that we grew up in fall apart. I think it's a tough thing for a lot of people that have lived their entire lives there. They've seen their children come up in those same communities, and then we start to lose our loved ones to that epidemic.
And what's something that we should keep in mind about this problem and the potential solutions as we emerge from this pandemic?
Again, I think it's something that we've got to start to take a good long look in the mirror. We do need to think outside the box. We do need to innovate. Again, corrections in Tennessee, it costs over $1 billion annually due to a rising incarceration rate. Incarceration rates across the U.S. tend to be going down. In Tennessee, they're still going up. Roughly 20 to 25% of those are for drug offenses. Around 40% of admissions are due to reincarceration for technical violations. And a lot of those are going to be drug related, like a dirty drug test. I think most people are reasonable enough when they do look at the facts to realize that it's difficult to expect someone to change or to address their substance use disorder if they don't have the resources to do it. Stigma is a major thing. And I think anybody can find the outlier or in their minds, the typical drug user and the negative names that are attached to that, the junkie, the dirtbag. And it's really easy to dehumanize that population. And as a former police officer, I get it. I do. You see them at their worst and you see all the things they're doing to support the substance use disorder. I think it's easy to forget sometimes that for those that do suffer from addiction, choice is increasingly being removed from the equation. Research is continuing to show us that their brains are structured differently. Everything from neural connections and pathways in the brain to hormone levels are different among that demographic of individuals. Their body's actively working against them. Their brain is actively working against them. If you don't give them the tools to succeed, they're not going to. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. I think we've done the same thing over and over again for long enough. It's time to start exploring some new avenues. And that's where, again, things like diversionary programs, drug courts, medication-assisted therapy, those things, study after study after study after study, showing us the same thing. If we can get people enrolled in these things, if they are available to these populations, especially in rural areas, they get better. They stop offending. They're able to directly address their substance use disorders because they have the support network to do it. And we've got a good example of that that was developed by Circuit Court Judge Dwayne Sloan in 2013. It's called the Tennessee Recovery Oriented Compliance Strategy, or TENROCS. It's a low-cost, high-impact strategy that he developed and implemented, and it was based on evidence-based practices, right? The long-lasting recovery strategies, clinical assessment, rapid linkage to best available treatment services, still expecting accountability from the users, but a focus on relationships. And that has actually become a model for things that are now being done across the country. And what he's done with that program, just in Granger and Jefferson counties, they actually had an independent research institute come in and evaluate what they were doing. And they saw more than a 50% reduction in sentences being served in those counties just over a 2-year span. It's working. There's no reason that we can't implement the same practices across Tennessee where they're most needed. But to do that, again, we've got to start addressing stigma, to educate ourselves, to get involved in the community, because there are other things that are happening in the background that are working in conjunction with this. Continued investment in prescription drug monitoring programs. We are seeing finally some accountability among medical professionals. We're seeing fewer scripts just handed out because that's actively being monitored. And we have networks of cooperation between law enforcement, between community organizations, and in the medical professions. You know, even things like joining an anti-drug coalition in your community, recognizing the Tennessee Red Line, looking at even, you know, infographics for Tennessee to recognize what's going on in your community, how it's been changing over time, and then reaching out to other members of the community. I've actually been very lucky here in the last year. I was invited to join a policy network that's a collaborative effort between the University of Tennessee across all its campuses, along with researchers and professionals in the field. So a website I can recommend to your listeners is for the Substance Misuse and Addiction Resource for Tennessee Policy Network, or SMART. Again, this is a partnership between researchers, policymakers, and addiction experts from across the state. Your listeners can go to https://smart.tennessee.edu, and you're going to see a whole host of resources here that can answer a lot of basic questions, that can link interested parties with resources from across the state. It's kind of serving as a forum for us to come together. We are producing policy briefs, everything from criminal justice reform to improved telehealth and broadband access. And those are things that we're hopeful will inform the legislature as they start to address this.
Rick, thanks so much for helping us to remember and shining a light not only on this problem, but also some of the solutions.
Well, again, Ray, I'm grateful for you making time and for continuing to make this a priority for Scenic Roots for your audience. You know, every time we meet, I wish that I had happier news for you. Times I feel like I'm just a broken record. We are making some headway. There's increased recognition among our electorate of the most effective ways to address these issues for Tennessee. And I think that people are finally starting to come around to the reality of this, that we can't keep doing the same thing. It's been ineffective. It's costing us lives. It's costing us money. It's costing us our communities and our families and loved ones. As depressing as these data are to look at, I really believe that maybe we're starting to round the corner.
All right, Rick, thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. A century ago, Rosenwald schools educated black children throughout the Jim Crow South despite segregation. Photographer Andrew Filer examines that story and what remains of those schools today in his new book, A Better Life for Their Children, Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington, and the 4,978 Schools That Changed America, published by the University of Georgia Press. Andrew spoke with us from Atlanta.
Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Tell us more about how you came up with the idea for this book.
I found myself at lunch one day with a preservationist leader here in Atlanta. This was in February of 2015, and she is the first person to have told me about Rosenwald Schools. I had just turned my first photography book into my publisher. I was thinking about what I was going to do next. This fit very much in the themes of the type of work that I do, but the story absolutely shocked me. I am a fifth-generation Jewish Georgian. I have been a progressive activist my entire life, and the pillars of the Rosenwald Schools story, Southern, progressive, activist, are the pillars of my life. How could I have never heard of this story? So I came home and I Googled Rosenwald Schools. And what I found is that there were several books on the topic, but there was not a comprehensive photo documentary on this program. And so I set out to do exactly that.
And to bring people up to speed who may be hearing about this for the first time or who haven't heard about this in a very long time, remind us who Julius Rosenwald was.
So Julius Rosenwald is born to Jewish immigrants in Springfield, Illinois. They had fled Germany and fled religious persecution. And he grows up across the street from Abraham Lincoln's home while Lincoln is resident in Springfield, Illinois. He rises to become the president of Sears Roebuck and Company. He turns Sears into the world's largest retailer. He leads the company from 1908 until his death in 1932. And he becomes one of the earliest and greatest philanthropists in American history. And his cause is what later becomes known as civil rights. And in 1911, he meets Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington, born into slavery, becomes an educator, is the founding principal of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And in 1911, you have to remember, this is before the Great Migration, which doesn't begin until later that decade. And 90% of African Americans live in the South, but public schools for African Americans are mostly shacks, with a fraction of the funding provided to the education of white children. Many jurisdictions do not even have public schools for African Americans. And so in 1912, they create this program that becomes known as Rosenwald Schools. And they reach out to the Black communities of the South and they say, we want you to be a full partner in your progress. So if you will contribute to a school and we will count as your contributions, cash, land, materials, and labor. And if you will reach out to the school board, the white school board, because these must be public schools. So the white school board has to agree to own, maintain, and staff the school, pay for the teachers.
And this was during Jim Crow segregation.
Jim Crow segregation. And if you do those things, Black communities involved, the white communities involved, Julius Rosenwald will make a substantial contribution towards school construction. And from 1912 to 1937, this program builds 4,978 schools across 15 southern and border states, and its impact is transformative.
And when we say transformative, we are talking about closing the gap in learning between Black students and white students during this time of Jim Crow segregation.
Absolutely. So there's two enormous impacts that the program has. First of all, there's two economists from the Federal Reserve Bank who have done five studies of Rosenwald Schools. And what their data shows is that prior to World War I, there was a large and persistent Black-white education gap in the South. That gap closes precipitously between World War I and World War II. And the single greatest driver of that achievement, and it is an achievement, is Rosenwald Schools. In addition, many of the leaders and foot soldiers of the movement to come through these schools. Medgar Evers, Maya Angelou, Congressman John Lewis, who wrote this absolutely glorious introduction to my book in which he describes his very first day of school, a Rosenwald school in Alabama. They all attended Rosenwald Schools.
How did you decide to capture this story through photos the way that you have in this book?
It's a great question because I knew from the beginning this was an amazing story. But how do you tell the story visually? And that was really challenging. So the first thing I would say is this. My process is to read and shoot and shoot and read. And the reading informs the shooting and the shooting informs the reading. And early on, I came across this extraordinary story. The program begins with a pilot of six schools all close to Tuskegee, where Booker T. Washington and his team can keep an eye on this. And Booker T. Washington has these photographs made of the students and teachers standing proudly in front of their schools, clearly representing the hopes and dreams of their community that, remember, has dug deep to help make these schools possible. And he sends these photographs to Julius Rosenwald, who writes back, he is so moved by these images that he is committing to expand the program. Most of my work prior to this project has been in color. But in homage to these images that become part of the visual history and language of this program, these students and teachers out in front of their schools, this body of work is entirely in black and white and entirely horizontal. So that was the first decision that I made. And then secondly, I started out doing exterior images of these schools. The exhibition of my first work was traveling. I would drive to Greensboro, North Carolina from Atlanta with all of the images lined up or stacked up in my wife's SUV. And I would line up Rosenwald schools and I would shoot them all the way up to Greensboro. And then I would shoot them all the way back. And then 4 months later, I'd go take the exhibition down and I would reshoot. And I started with these exteriors. But I quickly realized that that wasn't a comprehensive story because of the 4,978 schools, there's only about 500 that survive and only half of those have been restored. But they were too small to be continued to be used in as educational use as most of them. So only a handful remain in educational use. There is this plea for preservation as part of the story. There's an adaptive reuse narrative. So for the adaptive reuse narrative, I had to get inside the schools and that suddenly requires permission. And as I reach out to people to get permission to get inside of these schools, I am exposed to this extraordinary community, former students, former teachers, historians, preservationists. And I bring their amazing stories into this book through portraits of these folks. And then the last thing that I would say is, this is a book of photography, but I came across so many unbelievable stories, connections of Rosenwald schools to these poignant moments in American history, Trail of Tears, Great Migration, Tuskegee Syphilis Study, that for every image, or in some cases pairs of image, I wrote a short story to connect this narrative to the broader sweep of American history and American progress.
What's one story out of all of those that surprised you?
There's one story that I was absolutely shocked by. Oklahoma was one of the states in the Rosenwald Schools program. And we are generally familiar with the Trail of Tears, the displacement of five Native American tribes from east of the Appalachian Mountains to what later becomes Oklahoma. What we generally do not know is that each of those Native American tribes had black slaves, and they take them with them on their arduous journey west. And when emancipation comes, these African-American, newly emancipated African-Americans form all black townships for both safety purposes and commerce purposes. And they actually send recruiters to the South to say, come join us in our promised land. And I'll jump ahead. Toni Morrison's novel Paradise is set in these all black townships. There are 50 of them. And 11 of these black townships have Rosenwald schools. There is one surviving school, the Rosenwald Hall in Lima, Oklahoma. Photograph of that school is in my book, and I tell the story of the creation of these all-black townships. I found that to be absolutely shocking.
And what do you hope people take away from this book? I'm talking not only about people who would be familiar with the Rosenwald schools or the broader contours of the civil rights movement, but especially younger generations who might be hearing about this for the very first time.
Just two answers to that question. First and foremost, what I would say was the title of this book is A Better Life for Their Children. Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington, and the 4,978 Schools to Change America. I want to go back to this idea of a better life for their children. Julius Rosenwald was seeking a better life for his children. Booker T. Washington was seeking a better life for his children. The African-American communities that contributed to these schools and dug deep to do so were looking for better lives for their children. We often think that issues of public policy are intractable in America, particularly those surrounded by race. But these are folks that were fundamentally optimistic about America and prepared to play long ball. And collectively, they changed this country for the better. And I think the central narrative of this work is that our individual actions matter and we can change the world.
And beyond the book, if people want to keep up on your work, where can they go online?
My website is andrewfeiler.com. Feiler is F-E-I-L-E-R. I have a news section on this website. Also, I'm on social media where I'm posting about various efforts to preserve some of the surviving Rosenwald schools and new information. Where people can buy the books at their local independent bookstore. It's also available on Amazon, or you can buy signed or personalized copies on my website. The museum show of this work at the Center for Civil and Human Rights here in Atlanta. Will travel. It's currently booked into 2024.
All right. Andrew, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Besides trains, horses and mules carried the armies of the Civil War. Who took care of the animals and how'd they do it? On Saturday, a tour at Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park will explain, starting at 2 p.m. Brian Autry is a ranger with the park.
Well, this was an idea of mine that as people study the Civil War, they don't really get to hear a whole lot about the horses and the mules. We can't forget the mules, but this was one of the ways that the Army moved, hauled stuff, trains, boats, and horses and mules was the main category of transportation for these armies. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about how the horses were actually cared for, you know, and who actually did that. So it was just something I drug out of my head, tried to get a little bit of information out there. Studying of the veterinary medicine during the Civil War is something that's becoming very new at this time. So it's kind of how the United States military, especially the Army, from the Revolutionary War, everybody had a horse or a mule. And back then, most people would have brought their own horse. It took proper care. Horses and mules, there is maintenance that has to be done on them for them to perform. At the time, there was less than a handful of veterinarians. And you'll notice I'm not saying that there were veterinarians in the Army. This was veterinarians, most of them out of the military. It was left up to the riders. We'll start out here at the Chickamauga Battlefield Visitor Center at 2 o'clock. We'll actually car caravan out to a spot on the battlefield where a lot of horse activity took place. And then I will actually have one of the guys that really knows the Battle of Chickamauga. He's more or less an expert on it. He's not hired by the Park Service, of course, but we'll actually have his horse here. And he is an expert horseman, and he will actually help me with this program and demonstrate what it takes. His horse will not actually have a military saddle on and all that, but as far as the basic care of an animal that would have had to been done during the Civil War, he will be doing some demonstration on that. He will talk about, I'm sure, the shoeing of the horse, some of the brushing out of the horse, such things like that. I'm sure he's probably going to do some things that I don't even know about.
For more information about Saturday's tour, visit nps.gov/CH. Dr. Kelly Rodney Arnold is the founder and medical director of Clinica Medicos here in Chattanooga. She's the next guest on the A-List with Allison Lebovitz tonight at 8:30 p.m. on WTCI PBS.
How do you keep yourself grounded in the success without getting sort of mired by the reality that the underserved population continues to grow?
Yeah.
While your services remain not limited in scope, but you can only do what you can do. And when you look back 6 years, do you see, I'm sure you see the progress, but there's also got to be this reality check of how can we expand? How can we do more? Because that population is just continuing to be a larger presence within, especially the Chattanooga community.
Right. You know, I'm very grounded to how much team effort this requires. I have excellent partners, excellent staff. We went from 5, there are probably 45 to 50 of us now. We're larger.
Single one is bilingual.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Every single one. And most are a combination of first and second generation immigrants.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. We are like a family there. And I am continually checking in with what do we need? What are we thinking? Where are we going? What feels good? What's within our mission? And there are times in which the growth feels right and feels patient-driven versus feeling that we're going to expand just because we're successful. Those are two different things. And so on the heels of this pandemic, really we have reacted to the needs of our patients to go bigger, not smaller. And that has felt all very genuine. It's felt deliberate, and it feels similar to the way that we started. And so we're going to go for it. And that's going to mean more capacity for that growing population, but then really digging more into the needs of behavioral health and mental health for our patients and filling that gap, which is all really important to the health of a patient and to a family.
Watch the full conversation on the A-List with Allison Lebovitz tonight at 8:30 p.m. on WTCI PBS. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.